Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-decision episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Spencer Caron. On July 8, 2020, the Supreme Court decided Our Lady of Guadalupe versus Morrissey Beru. In a 7-2 ruling, the court held that a ministerial exemption derived from the First Amendment prevents civil courts from adjudicating schoolteacher Morrissey Beru's age discrimination claim. Justice Alito, in writing for the majority, held that the process of identifying who serves as a religious minister within a specific faith group must be largely left up to that particular faith group, resulting in the reversal of the Ninth Circuit's determination that Morrissey Beru was not a minister. Joining us to discuss this case and its implications is Daniel Blomberg, senior counsel at the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty.
So today's two decisions, the combined decisions in Our Lady and St. James, are very important decisions and very helpful in further establishing what the unanimous court did 8 years ago in Hosanna-Tabor, a doctrine known as the ministerial exception. Then I'm going to walk through the case that the court decided today, give you some background on that, and talk about the court's ruling, including what made it distinct from the Hosanna-Tabor case, why the court was why it took it and why it was resolving it. And then I'm going to discuss a couple of key takeaways from the decision on what it does to further establish and solidify the First Amendment's protections for religious groups. So first, a brief overview, the takeaways from today's decision. The doctrine that's at issue is the First Amendment's religion clauses, protection for the internal autonomy of a religious group and their ability to select their leaders and their teachers and people who embody and express the faith within the context of the religious group. And so today's decision regarded two teachers that had sued their schools, their Catholic schools, over the school's decision not to renew their contracts. And the court, by a 7-2 margin, ruled in favor of the schools and found that the First Amendment protected the school's decision about selecting who to serve in a teaching capacity at the schools. So this is a huge win for all faith groups. The defendants here were Catholic schools, but as the court recognized today, there's a rich diversity of religious education in this country, and it specifically identified the many different faith traditions, Catholics, Protestants, Jews, Muslims, Adventists, Mormons, and others that have a strong emphasis on religious education and training up the next generation. And so the protections that the court recognized today apply to all of those faith groups in really profound ways. It's also a very important decision because it protects from government entanglement in core religious decisions. So one way to think of this is a very healthy separation of church and state in a case that really goes to the heartland of what the religion clauses working together are trying to do. The other thing that's really important coming out of today's decision is that it shows us that the form of the doctrine follows the function of the doctrine. That is, what really matters, what the courts really are trying to get at, is protecting the ability of religious groups to perpetuate their existence, to perpetuate their message and what they're trying to speak to their members and to people who choose to be a part of their associations. And so it's not so much about titles and other formalistic considerations as it is about what exactly is being done. It protects that core expression of religious belief and identity. And the final point that's really important is that this is a 7-2 win. That is, you have 7 justices in the majority saying that the schools should win in this context. And that really speaks to the breadth of support for religious liberty in our society. And in fact, while it's a 7-2 decision on the core dispute that came before the court, it's actually a 9-0 decision when it comes to issues like Hosanna Tabor. All nine justices agree that the Hosanna Tabor case was rightly decided. Now, two of the justices have some disagreement about what Hosanna Tabor means, but all of them affirm it as strong precedent, just as they did 8 years ago when Hosanna Tabor was decided. Next, all nine justices agree that while they disagree on this particular case, you know, two of them disagree with seven of them on this particular case, agree that the ministerial exception covers termination for religious reasons. So if a religious group decides to hire or fire someone for a religious reason, then that someone holds an important religious role within the ministry, then all the justices would agree that situation should be covered by the ministerial exception. So one of the big takeaways is that this case is marked by wide agreement on some of the very fundamental issues. Okay, so that's a brief overview of what we got out of the Our Lady decision today. Let me step back a little bit, step back a lot, and talk about how we got here, where we're coming from. And you have to go way back in history. You have to go back to Magna Carta when you're talking about the ministerial exception, because it really is rooted deeply in our traditions, and both ones that we – things that we wanted to keep as a society, things we wanted to protect, and things that we were trying to try to avoid. So for instance, before the time of the founding, there were requirements in law in Britain that individuals could face lifetime imprisonment. Ministers could face lifetime imprisonment for preaching anything but what was in the official prayer book, the Book of Common Prayer. I don't remember what the first and second violations were, but the third violation, if you were teaching something as a minister other than what was in the Book of Common Prayer, you could face lifetime imprisonment. And you were forbidden to say anything, and I quote, this is in the decision today, say anything in plays, songs, rhymes, or by other open words that would be in violation of the Book of Common Prayer. So you had very strong state control of religious belief and religious expression. And that really kind of followed us across the pond as our nation was getting started, and Professor Michael McConnell noted that in early colonial Virginia, ministers were politically appointed by the crown, and the religious faithful that were a part of those congregations often were less than excited about that, because as you might imagine, politically appointed ministers were less than zealous in their spiritual responsibilities and less than irreproachable in their personal morals. That's a quote from Professor McConnell's seminal work on establishment and disestablishment of the founding. So there was a lot of control both over religious beliefs and over the ministers that were responsible for expressing those beliefs. And at the time of the founding, when we were put together and ratified the First Amendment, we wanted to get away from all that. We wanted to put the power to select ministers and express religious belief in the hands of religious congregations and not in the hands of politicians. And so we have the First Amendment's religion clauses. And it, both sides, there's been some cases that have said, there's a little bit of tension between what the Establishment Clause is trying to do and what the Free Exercise Clause is trying to do, and they kind of bump up each other against each other sometimes. But that's not the case here, because here, when it comes to selecting the ministers who express the faith, the Free Exercise Clause says, well, religious groups have to be free to select those individuals, and because that's how they, identify and form themselves around common beliefs and select somebody who can express those beliefs. So they have the Free Exercise Clause protects the right of a religious group to select their ministers. And then on the other side, the Establishment Clause bars the government from getting involved in that decision. So both sides of this are working together. On one side, the Free Exercise protects that ability to make the choice. On the other side, the Establishment Clause says the government has to stay out of it. So that was what the Establishment and Free Exercise Clause, a big part of what they were meant to do. It was really kind of a heartland function, was protecting this ability of religious groups to be able to make their own decisions on the people who really kind of express their faith and lead their faith. And so what the court was telling us today were a few different things. One, really, as I mentioned earlier, form follows function. The core consideration, the core ruling here is is summed up in this paragraph and says, what matters at bottom is what an employee does. And then the court goes on, it says, implicit in our decision in Hosanna Tabor was a recognition that educating young people in their faith, inculcating its teachings, and training them to live their faith are the responsibilities that lie at the very core of the mission of a private religious school. And so while the court didn't go beyond that question, didn't answer, you know, other types of teachers and those types of situations, it says where you have a teacher who's responsible for educating and forming students in the faith, judicial intervention has to stop. That has to be the end of it, because any more interference ends up becoming an entanglement with religion, and it ends up, you know, having, you know, requiring judges to second guess religious judgments, and you end up with at its core an interference with the religious beliefs of the organization. Because really, you know, part of what the core understanding, the thing that kind of drives what's going on with the ministerial exception, is the idea that personnel is policy. And so allowing the government to get involved in the selection or termination of ministers ultimately means allowing the government to get involved in the expression and content of religious belief, which is a big, big no-no. And so the ministerial exception exists to preserve a church's independent authority in matters of preaching and teaching and expressing the faith and performing, you know, rituals of the faith. And so at the core of what the ministerial exception is trying to do is protecting the autonomy of the church to decide for itself what it is and how it gets to kind of express itself and conceptualize itself. And so that's what the court did today. And it went back and it looked carefully at the Ninth Circuit's basis for its holding, and it said, listen, in the Hosanna Tabor decision, we were really clear that we were not adopting a rigid test. That's exactly what we said. We're not adopting a rigid test. And so you got it wrong when you came behind us and assumed that what we were doing was, in fact, adopting a four-factor test instead of four considerations, really treating them as four factors, and all those boxes need to be checked. The court said that was just fundamentally incorrect. And the court also said, you know, the respondents here would have wanted to go further. They actually wanted to make it a four-factor test, and a four-factor test that started primarily with the three formalistic criteria. Like, you only considered this fundamental aspect of function, you know, what an employee does, what exactly is being performed for the religious group. You only get there after you look and see and confirm, yes, they have a religious title, yes, they have religious training, and yes, they have some sort of religious, you know, legal status, you know, like a tax status or something like that. And so unless you can show those things, you don't even get to the question of the kind of religious stuff that they're doing. And the court pointed out that raises a host of problems, not least among them that you then end up in a situation where you could have somebody who, you know, certain faith groups don't have formal religious titles for their ministers. They don't call their ministers ministers. And certain faith groups actually think that's theologically wrong. You know, there's a certain equality of all believers, for instance, in the Islamic faith. And so there's not this expectation that you're going to have, for instance, ordained clergy within those other faith groups, often minority faith groups. And so the ones that would be hurt by this test would often be the ones with whom the country and people in the judiciary and the government would be least familiar with and least comfortable with, minority faith groups. And in fact, interestingly, some of the, you know, there haven't been that many ministerial exception cases following the 2012 decision in Hosanna Tabor, but several of them have been with minority faith groups, including three, for instance, with Jewish faith groups. And so these are the kinds of groups that are often most protected by the ministerial exception, because they're the ones that the government would be and the courts would be least familiar with. And so protecting, drawing this broad circle around their ability to select their teachers and leaders is particularly useful for faith groups that would otherwise would otherwise suffer disproportionately. So the court identified that problem with the respondent's theory of the case and how they were trying to press it. The court also rejected the respondent's argument that the teacher's argument that the you had to show that someone was a co-religionist in order for them to be a minister, right? So the argument here was that to fit within the ministerial exception, to be a voice of the faith, you had to be a member of the faith. And there's a certain kind of facial appeal to that, certain surface appeal to it. But the court pointed out that it's, the devil's in the details, so to speak. And as soon as you start digging in, you see, well, how is a court supposed to decide whether or not someone is a member in good standing of a particular faith group? And why is a faith group limited in that way? I mean, if a faith group decides that they want to put their, for instance, a seminary, for instance, wants to put its Old Testament teaching class in the hands of an Orthodox Jew who might have significant scholarly understanding of those, as long as they can, ask that individual, this Christian seminary, as long as they can ask that individual to teach in a way that's consistent with the faith, there's no reason from, an expressive perspective why they couldn't ask that individual, allow that individual to teach, the Torah and other books of the common, books of the Christian and Jewish Testament, Old Testament and Torah. So the court rejected that and saying, how are we as court supposed to determine whether or not, for instance, a Reformed Jew and an Orthodox Jew are sufficiently the same kind of Jew, or a, Southern Baptist and an American Baptist? How is it a court is supposed to make those kind of determinations of what a co-religionist is? And there was also an argument, a related argument, that, maybe that one of the teachers here had been a Catholic, but she was no longer a Catholic, and so the ministerial exception shouldn't apply to her. And the court was kind of threw up its hands at that and said, well, how is the court supposed to determine what a good Catholic is? And really, I mean, why would we put that kind of burden on a religious group for them to have to, go snooping behind their teachers and their leaders to ferret out whether or not they were, sufficiently up to speed on the faith? And so the court rejected those arguments because of the kind of religious entanglement and interference that they would necessarily entail.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.